This week, we dive into Gen Z and Gen Alpha with such varied and broad differences in how these generations lead their lives. Does Freemasonry have in it some way to teach the values that Masonry currently upholds? Or does Masonry simply not have what it takes to address the two newest generations? Then, we'll explore the cardinal virtues, prudence, temperance, fortitude, justice. Which of those describes willpower? Which one is self-control? In a new article from Science News, we'll read a piece that explores the difference between these two virtues using the analogy of a Greek mythology, the story of Odysseus sailing home to Ithaca after the Trojan War. All this and more, if you have the fortitude to stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 623. I want to thank our supporters of the show, those contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners, for making the WCY podcast what it is today, which is the number one trusted source for Masonic education in a podcast format, and we couldn't be here without you. So, huge thanks to all of you. If you're out there, you've been listening, and you're thinking, hey, how can I help the podcast spread Masonic education to anyone interested in Freemasonry? Well, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options. Now, of course, the shop and the bookstore and Skull and Crown Limited, all of those things go back to assisting this program as well. So there are many ways to assist, and we appreciate it. Now, if it sounds weird, it's because I have a cold. But this is a podcast. I don't have to be in a crazy office or get anybody sick. So the job goes on as long as I can read, which I can. So here we are. In other news, it sounds like the Grand Lodge of Texas was having all of those crazy issues, and it sounds like Brotherhood did prevail. So congrats to all the Grand Lodge members, the constituents, officers. Sounds like y'all made it happen. Congratulations. And thanks to all of those cooler heads that prevailed. As far as presentations, I did want to mention that January 29th, I will be doing an online presentation topic for the District of Ontario, Canada. And I'm hoping to see many of you out at Masonic Week. So if you end up coming out there, perhaps I will find you, or you'll find me, and we can share a coffee or something and listen to some great Masonic education and share some fellowship, see what's going on the national scale of things. Very exciting time. But now let's go ahead and get into the education this week. If you recall, a couple of weeks ago, I read an article that I wrote about leadership in Freemasonry and how I kind of disagreed with the pushing of a leadership as something that Masonry should focus on. This was then followed up last week with a reading of Darren Lehner's follow-up to my piece, and this week we've got another perspective on this issue, which comes from one of the most well-informed, one of the most academic, and honestly, all-around trustworthy brothers, worshipful brother Patrick Day. His piece is another follow-up, and talks about many other issues that Darren and I both either glossed over or didn't go into at all. So, here is his piece, The Problematic Reality for Masonic Leadership for Younger Generations. And I think this is where we need to focus. His calling on how this is perceived by younger generations. Let's check it out. I suppose I am hopping on the bandwagon of commentary to Robert Johnson's recent post about leadership in Masonry. I applaud him for saying what must be said. Masonry is not a leadership school, and Darren Lehner's follow-up post was equally as applaudable in examining many of the points RJ discusses. Thank you both for saying it. I am chiming in on this commentary to point out something that I think gets overlooked. What Generation Z and the upcoming Gen Alpha think about these things. These are very different generations than previous generations, and their ambitions, wants, desires, means of expression, social acceptance, and the rest are vastly different from any currently living generations. First and foremost, it needs to be pointed out to older Masons that I am not the young generation anymore. I am a millennial, and that means I am not the new generation of Masons. I am not a kid. I am not one of the young ones. Baby boomers, and even the silent generation, and even the elder Gen X have long been infantilizing millennials that they don't even realize that Gen Z is here. They have dismissed millennials for so long as being just kids that don't know what they're talking about, that they still think we are the kids. Now Gen Z has arrived. The elder Gen Zs can vote. They are graduating college. They can buy alcohol, start businesses, run for some political offices, and some are starting to join Freemasonry. And Gen Z thinks millennials are the old farts who need to get out of the way. They think millennials are old, has-beens, and irrelevant. And they're not wrong. I don't want to turn this into an okay boomer type of bashing older generations, but truth be told, the silent generation and baby boomers are out of touch with the younger generations. They don't seem to be aware that there is a younger generation on the scene now, while they still continue to call millennials kids and the future of Masonry. As a result, their conception of what the younger generations want and need, even their ideas on the future leaders of Masonry, are so incredibly out of touch with reality, and a few things need to be brought to the older Masons' attention. I'm not going to pretend that I understand Gen Z, or even Gen Alpha, any more than baby boomers understand Gen X or millennials. We aren't meant to understand younger generations. That's just how it works. It is a sign of progress. It is a sign that things are not stagnating. Whether you like it or not, younger people will come along and change things, and grumpy old men complain and die, and the world keeps turning. That said, I pay attention to Gen Z enough, and I follow the trends enough, that I feel I can speak to a few trends that Masonry will have to contend with. Foreshadowing, your outdated lectures, seminars, and papers about leadership in Masonry are not only going to need revisions, but maybe should just be tossed out entirely, and we forget we even brought this whole thing up. Some years ago, I was present at a presentation being given by a past Grand Master, I believe from Tennessee. He gave a statistic about Masonry's membership, one that Darren Lonners and gave in his follow-up to RJ's post, and it is a statistic I absolutely loathe. It's so asinine. There are approximately 130 million males between the ages of 18 and 65 of age in the United States, and of them, 880,000 of them are Freemasons. About 0.5% of the male population. Darren was not so dense as to ask this next question, but this past Grand Master did. Why aren't the rest of these men Masons? I have seen this statistic and insane question given several times, and I'm sure many of you have as well. Darren acknowledges the complexity of this idea, though he does not get into it. However, I will, because it reflects deeply upon how different the younger generations feel and operate in life, and how that will impact the future of Freemasonry. When that Grandmaster asked that question, why aren't the rest of these men Freemasons? I wanted so badly to shout out, or at least to approach him afterwards and ask, how many of those men are atheists? How many are transgender? How many have criminal records? How many are black in a state that doesn't admit persons of color? Why does the MSANA's data not reflect Prince Hall membership statistics? How many do not care about Freemasonry? Truth be told, he probably would not care. That statistic was just a talking point in a longer presentation on leadership and Masonry that was a little more than the same old jive. Seriously. It was the same ideas of bygone era that he still thinks are relevant, but really are not. He talked about how younger generations need community. That's a need they have that Freemasonry can provide. No shit. Of course, they want community. We are humans. We are social creatures. That's not something special about the kids. That's just a basic human need. His proposal, the lodge should host bowling nights and golf tournaments. Yeah. You know, the last time I went bowling was in high school, and that was just an excuse to smoke cigarettes indoors with my friends and hope the food vendor didn't ID me when I tried to buy beer. Golf? I remember a few years ago hearing a bunch of baby boomers complaining that millennials are killing golf because we don't want to play golf. So his proposal was that lodges get their millennial brethren to play golf. This guy was a prime example of what RJ and Darren are saying about why leadership courses for masonry should be taught by an accredited person or company. There is a new generation coming into masonry, if they even care to join masonry, and trying to get them to play golf is a shibboleth of how out of touch the proposer of such an idea really is. A few years ago, at a Colorado lodge, a few of the young guys wanted to start their own hangout time at the lodge building. They decided to start a game night where they used that huge flat-screen TV the lodge bought and play Halo or Call of Duty on it. I think they ended up ordering pizza and playing Dungeons & Dragons. Every other week, they met at the building and played games together. Then the older Masons got involved, and because they didn't understand what these games were about, they took it over and turned it into a fellowship talk time, and it died in a month. The kids had a good idea. Unplug from the computer at home and come to the lodge and plug in together. Then the older Masons destroyed it because they felt excluded, and then complained the younger Masons didn't want to hang out anymore. Sometimes the best leader is the guy who knows when he needs to step aside. Here were the kids, starting something, nurturing fellowship in their own way. And then the leaders, quote-unquote, inserted themselves and then wondered why the quote-unquote kids didn't want to do the things the way we did things back in my day. Let's really get into this. What is the future of masonry, with Gen Z coming in, and how will that affect leadership in masonry? Truth be told, we're looking at a generation unlike any other. Whatever was the established rule book about leadership and management, Gen Z burned it. What's their approach to leadership? They don't care about leadership. They don't care about management positions. They literally do not give a shit. Caveat. Of course, there are some Zoomers who are interested in leadership and management, but the great majority of them don't. This is an example of Freemasonry being a reflection of our society at large, and that civic politics and economics are going to have an impact on Masonry. These kids don't want management roles because it does not pay, or it pays poorly. There are hundreds of TikTok videos out there on how to properly decline a promotion at work, or how to politely and legally decline being given management roles. Gen Z got smart. Millennials, we got suckered into taking on these added responsibilities because we believed it would give us a rapport and that the financial benefits would come later. And then we are told after 2 years without a pay raise that the company does not promote from within. Millennials thought if we put in overtime without compensation, we would reap the rewards later. And those fruits rotted on the vine. We got a pizza party that didn't even feed everyone there, instead of the cash bonuses that we were promised. Gen Z got smart and decided that they would not stay late or come in early on weekends. They learned to not take a work call after hours or on their day off. The media came to calling this quiet quitting, but the reality is that no one likes being taken advantage of, and Gen Z learned real quick from the failings of millennials to not take leadership roles and to not put in the extra effort. They completed their terms of their contract and could care less about anything else. Freemasonry cannot afford to market itself as a place to learn leadership skills to a generation that could not give a damn. Why would they pay to be a Mason and volunteer their time and energy to leadership roles when they don't even want to be paid for leadership roles at work? They don't want to manage other people and other projects on top of all their other responsibilities while not seeing a pay raise for it, and we expect them to pay us to learn leadership skills from people who are out of touch and poor leaders in the first place to volunteer their time to manage other people? Masonry is going to have a big problem in the future by pushing leadership agenda if no one wants it at all. Why would they want to learn leadership skills to be a better husband and father when many Zoomers are not having kids? We are entering an era of population busts. 2020 was anticipated to be a boom year because everyone was home, and when you're bored, you have sex, and sex leads to children. We see small booms after hurricanes because when you're stuck inside with no TV and no power, seeing by candlelight, you get a recipe for making babies. But 2020 was a bust year in 2021. Millennials cannot afford to have children. Daycare is $25,000 a child these days. One partner basically works to pay for daycare, their whole paycheck goes to childcare. If you want to increase the population, the parents need to have three kids, two to replace the parents, and one to add to the general population. But now they can't afford to even stabilize the population. Many who truly want kids will only have one because that is all they can afford. But so many are opting for no kids at all. Many do not even like kids, much less the idea of having to care for a child for the next 20 years of their life. And we think Freemasonry can bill itself to make men better fathers? Being a better husband? Polyamory is more prolific today than decades ago. Polyamorous relationships are nothing like monogamous relationships, and thus leadership is going to be vastly different from anything Masonry could teach, if it could teach such things. Masonry's leadership is structured with a master as the chief executive, and everyone below him serves his will and pleasure. Kinky, but this does not work in a polyamorous relationship. It might be better suited for symptom relationships than poly. Heck, even monogamous marriages of younger generations are way different from how previous generations conducted their marriages, if they even get married. Some are fine with partnerships. And if they have kids, co-parenting. These are accepted now, and the emerging generations see it as perfectly normal. Is Masonry even ready to have discussions on these types of relationships, much less the leadership skills to be successful partners in these arrangements? Let's look at a historical example, interracial marriages. Today, these are not a big deal, and in fact are quite common, but 50 years ago, or more, they were very taboo, and that affected Freemasonry. Some years ago, I met a Caucasian Prince Hall Mason who was initiated back in the 1970s. I asked him why he joined Prince Hall, and he said, well, I did petition a four-letter lodge, their name for our Blue Lodge system, but they blackballed me for being married to a black woman. And since I was ostracized in a lot of white groups, but welcomed into a lot of black communities, I just felt more at home in Prince Hall. Let this example be a reminder that our own prejudices have caused many to avoid Freemasonry and find their need to be a part of a community elsewhere. Let's talk about sexuality. As far as I'm aware, Tennessee and Georgia are the only Grand Lodges in the United States that explicitly prohibit homosexuals from being Masons. This is such a big deal that NPR published an article about two Masons who married each other and were subsequently brought up on un-Masonic charges. This is so preposterous, Latin for ass backward, and what these Grand Lodges do not understand is that homosexuality is not a concern among most of the younger generations. They're much more open and tolerant about it than their predecessors, and it is part of the reason why more and more homosexuals and bisexuals are coming out these days. To go back to that past Grand Master from Tennessee's remarks about why aren't all these other men Masons, I've got some statistics for him. According to U.S. Census data, in 2019, the adult male population of Tennessee was approximately 3.5 million, and of those men, 120,000 were open homosexuals and bisexuals, according to a Gallup/Williams poll that same year. According to the Masonic Service Association, in 2019, the number of Tennessee Freemasons was approximately 32,000. That means there were 3.7 times more open homosexuals in Tennessee than Masons. That number should sting a little. So why aren't all these men Freemasons? Even in jurisdictions that have no stance on sexuality, it is not uncommon to hear some homophobic comments from the brethren, even in Lodge. I'm bisexual, and I have had to shut down some repulsive remarks from men that I am supposed to call brother. And they would apologize, but mostly because they didn't want to have to elect a new secretary that night. I suppose similar remarks in a similar situation could be discussed about transgender, queer, and gender-fluid persons, which are becoming more and more acceptable as younger generations emerge. And I don't think the older Masons are ready to give seminars to address leadership for LGBTQ persons. Not even close. Back to what RJ and Darren say about accredited leadership trainers, I'm sure they've undergone sensitivity training that a past Grand Master from 1972 never even knew was an option. Atheism is another big hurdle for Masonry. Masonry explicitly prohibits atheists from being Masons. It is not just atheism that is rising. The number of young people who do not care about religion, or believing in a god or gods or anything numinous whatsoever. I remember some years ago when I was living in Boston, I met a young man at MIT, and it came up during a conversation about sacred geometry that he said he didn't believe in God. And almost without missing a beat, he said, "But don't call me an atheist. Don't lump me in with those loudmouths. I don't care if there is a God or not." And that trend in belief or disbelief is rapidly rising. Yet at the same time, those who are religious keep declining and those who are atheists keep rising. I doubt religion will go away or that it will become completely marginal, but the Pew Research Center estimates that by 2070, Christians will no longer hold the majority in the United States. I find that a lot of Masonic leadership lectures and courses certainly lean toward a religious quality, especially the York Rite leadership courses. The continuous rise of atheism and non-theism in this country will not just affect the number of men who are qualified to become Masons, but it will affect the number of men who are qualified to become Masons, but will affect how Masons tailor their pitches for Masonic leadership. I'm not arguing we need to suddenly let atheists in. No, not even remotely close. What I am trying to illustrate is that the younger generations value things that are very different. Wanting to use traditional values to provide leadership training in Masonry is going to be challenging when those traditions are taking on incredibly new forms or being discarded entirely. Certainly, we are going to need to make a decision about transgender persons, such as if they identify as a man, regardless of their genitals at birth, and they should be let in. Or we must adopt a decision like the United Grand Lodge of England made a few years ago that, if they discover they identify as a woman after becoming a Mason, then they cannot be expelled. Something, anything needs to be addressed rather than what I personally heard several leaders in my own jurisdictions and others say, "Kick that can down the road." Some quality leadership right there to just postpone the inevitable until it comes to a head. For years, Masons have been trying to integrate the internet into the fraternity, and for years, Masons have argued that the old-timers don't know how all these internet thingies work, so we shouldn't do anything on the internet because we don't want to exclude them. Then lockdown happened, and most jurisdictions were forced to move onto the internet or lose all that precious momentum Masonry then had, and could not afford to lose even a little bit thereof. Then suddenly all those old-timers we said didn't understand the internet were on virtual lodge meetings. It wasn't a problem. All along it was as simple as create an account, click this link, and you're in a meeting. They got the hang of it so quickly that they then oversaturated every Mason's schedule with endless Zoom meetings that burned everyone else out really quick. For a long time, Masons have been saying that Masonry needs to make some changes. This is true. However, Masonry has done very little, if anything, to negotiate those changes, and the high tide of change is approaching very rapidly, when Masons will no longer be saying, "How shall we accommodate younger generations?" and Masons will be forced to accommodate or perish. I really doubt Masonry will ever go away. Somehow, the Order of Red Men still exists. What I expect is that Masonry will continue its course of dwindling numbers, and after enough very lovely Masonic funerals, after all of the old guard are moldering in their graves, there will be a few of the new generations that say to themselves, "Why are we still doing things the way those dead people did it?" And they will make the changes that suit them. Patrick M. Day. Patrick is the past master of Nevada Lodge No. 4 in the ghost town of Nevadaville, Colorado, and currently serves as their secretary, and is also a past master of the Research Lodge of Colorado. He is a past high priest of Keystone Chapter No. 8, past illustrious master of Hiram Council No. 7, past commander of Flatirons Commandery No. 7. He currently serves as the exponent, the suffragan of Colorado College SRICF, of which he is 8th grade magister. He is the editor of Rocky Mountain Mason magazine and serves on the board of directors of the Grand Lodge of Colorado's Library and Museum Association, and is the deputy grand bartender of the Grand Lodge of Colorado, an ad hoc joke position he is very proud to hold. He holds a Master's of Architecture degree from the University of Colorado, Denver, and works in the field of architecture in Denver, where he resides with his wife and son. There you have this great piece from Worshipful Brother Patrick Day on this problem of Masonic leadership for younger generations. What I really enjoy here about this piece is that he is addressing some things that I think we really need to think about. And I think the normal person, the normie person who's going to be reading this, who would get, the type of person who would get triggered by some of the things in this post about polyamory or gender fluidity and all of these things, these are real hot topics for a lot of people out there. But he's not doing any advocating here or talking about letting these people in or doing any of that. He's simply saying that as these things are becoming more and more open, because the newer generations of people simply don't care about projecting what they might consider some sort of religious morality onto those people. And because of that, it is a non-starter for anyone to bring in those types of arguments regarding Masonry. So when you go to a leadership course on Masonry and if Masonry makes good men better, the question remains is that the people that we have teaching our brothers, the types of ideologies that are behind the extrapolation of Masonic ideas as they relate to newer societies, will those brothers who are doing the teaching, will they be able to say anything relevant? Well, I think so, but there are going to be a minority of folks who just might hit on any one of these lifestyles and ways of thinking that future generations and existing generations, younger ones, and how they think. I certainly wonder, and I think I might post something about this, but I certainly wonder, in terms of leadership, how much continuing education do Grand Lodge officers get? I'd love to know that. Anyway, on to the next piece, which just happens to come from one of my favorite websites, sciencenews.org. This article caught my eye because the title is about self-control and willpower. And I think this is something that we as a fraternity talk to when we think about the tenets and cardinal virtues of Freemasonry. The title of this is called, "Most people say self-control is the same as willpower. Researchers disagree." In this sense, we're talking about the psychology where we think that self-control is about planning ahead, which is to avoid needing to use willpower in any given moment or situation. So let's dive into this and see how our thoughts about the cardinal virtues like temperance, prudence, fortitude, and justice directly relate to both willpower and self-control. Let's check it out. "Most people say self-control is the same as willpower. Researchers disagree." By Sujata Gupta, January 3rd, 2024, posted 7 a.m., sciencenews.org. A full link back to the original article will be posted. Please follow them and get on their mailing list, because you won't regret it. A scientific squabble over how to define self-control draws from an unlikely source, a story from Greek mythology. Sailing home to Ithaca after the Trojan War, Odysseus longed to hear the sirens' legendary song. But he knew that was a very bad idea. The sirens, the goddess Circe had warned, lured passing sailors to their island to kill them. So Circe helped Odysseus form a plan. As his boat approached the sirens' island, Odysseus handed crew members balls of wax to plug their ears, and he ordered the men to tie him firmly to the boat's mast. He told the crew to tie him tighter if he begged and pleaded to heed the sirens' call. His plan in place, Odysseus was able to both hear the sirens and live to tell the tale. The science is clear. Proverbially, tying oneself to the mast or crafting strategies in advance to thwart temptation is the optimal way to meet one's goals, but not all agree that such preemptive strategies constitute self-control. Social psychologists say Odysseus utilized exemplary self-control. That's because they tend to distinguish between strategic self-control, that is, the Odysseus approach, and willpower. Willpower would be akin to Odysseus resisting the siren's call in the moment without rope and muscular crewmen. Some social scientists, though, have started to push back against that linguistic split. Most laypeople use both willpower and self-control to refer to resisting temptation in the moment, says Sean Risrapata, a psychiatric neuroscientist and philosopher at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. As such, they view Odysseus' decision to tie himself to the mast not as an act of self-control, but an admission that he lacked it. The Odysseus case, quote, is a vivid example of how pre-commitment, pre-planning, and things like that aren't called by ordinary people self-control, Srapata says. Ivory tower infighting over what does and does not constitute self-control might seem like a battle with low stakes. Experts largely agree that preemptive planning is the best way to achieve one's goal. So who cares if the route to success reflects self-control or something else? All roads, after all, lead to Ithaca. The issue does matter, Srapata insists. Consider this festive time of year. Social scientists often appear in the media as experts who can help people achieve their New Year's resolutions. But if those experts are speaking a different language than their audience, their message may not sink in. And people are truly terrible at meeting their resolutions. One survey found that roughly 40% of people in the United States make resolutions, but less than half complete that resolution by year's end. Roughly, a third of resolution setters don't make it past the 3-month mark. Another survey showed that most adult Americans think they'll fail at their resolutions due to, you guessed it, a lack of willpower. Think of it this way, Srapata says. If he told his patients to exercise self-control to avoid sweets, they would think he meant resisting the immediate craving to eat a freshly baked cookie. They would not think he meant taking the long route home to avoid driving past the bakery. Quote, you have to communicate with people using familiar vocabulary, Srapata says, Odysseusizing self-control. In recent years, psychological terms have been infiltrating everyday speech. In the process, words like gaslighting, triggered, narcissistic, toxic, traumatized, and flourishing have become diluted and imprecise. The term self-control shows that similar mistranslations also occur in reverse. The idea of self-control emerged thousands of years ago. For instance, The Laws, a book delving into political philosophy, ethics, theology, and psychology, Plato asserted that self-control compensated for a lack of strategic planning. Researchers wrote in the March 2023 Review of Philosophy and Psychology, by comparison, scientists entered the self-control discourse relatively recently. Other concepts such as attention, memory, motivation, and desire have followed similar trajectory from lay discourse to scientific jargon, says philosopher and cognitive scientist Juan Pablo Bermudez, a co-author on the study, quote, once these words come into the science, they change, Sometimes they change for the better. Sometimes they get muddier. Self-control seems to be a case of the latter, says Bermudez. To be clear, scientists' heart are in the right place. In early times, it was known that people reporting high levels of inner self-control as measured by responses to questions such as, I am good at resisting temptations, or I get carried away by my feelings, tended to report higher levels of well-being and academic achievement and more stable relationships than the general public. Scientists assumed that people strong in self-control were simply better at others at muscling through temptation. How, they wanted to know, could others strengthen that muscle? But then research began to emerge that challenged that framework. In one study, researchers analyzed the results of about 100 self-control studies of almost 33,000 participants. People who scored high in self-control were no better than others resisting the temptation in the moment, those scientists reported in the February 2012 Personality and Social Psychology Review. Instead, such individuals reported having established habits or routines. In another study, researchers pinged over 200 people on beepers several times a day to measure their desires in real time. Individuals who scored high in self-control reported experiencing less temptation and weaker desires than those with lower scores. The team reported in the June 2012 Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Those studies led to a seismic shift in the field of self-control, says social psychologist Malte Fries of Saarland University in Saarbrücken, Germany, who was not involved in that work. Quote, apparently the people who are good in self-control don't inhibit all day long. They do something different. End quote. Thus began the willpower self-control split. Scientists began exploring the tools that could help people do those different things while sticking to the moniker self-control. Some research focused on strategies people could call on in the moment to move beyond simple willpower to resist temptation, says Kentaro Fujita, a social psychologist at Ohio State University in Columbus. For instance, research has shown that distracting oneself or focusing on the negative aspects of a temptation can help people overcome immediate desires. But with evidence mounting that pre-planning, a la Odysseus, presented the key to long-term success, that's where researchers focused their attention, says Fujita, who outlined those strategies in the October 2020 Policy Insights from the Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Some tips include linking goal failure to self-imposed punishment, such as forcing oneself to donate to a loathed organization. Another involves bundling a disliked action, say, running with a desirable one, such as listening to a favorite podcast. This article challenges a common belief that successful self-control requires willpower, Fujita and his co-authors wrote. Commoners missed the memo. Sripada's research shows that people who aren't regularly designing or participating in research studies don't disentangle the terms willpower and self-control. His team tested how people think about self-control in a study published in the August 2022 Cognition. In one experiment, the team sought to replicate the Odysseus story through a different tale. This one, about a man named Mo and his desire to eat less cheese. The researchers had 86 online participants read one of several vignettes. In one scenario, a counterpart to the tying himself to the mast story, Mo gives his block of cheddar to a roommate so that he won't eat it later. Despite begging and pleading for his cheese the next day, the roommate denies his request. In an alternate scenario, Mo doesn't preemptively hand off the cheese. Instead, when the roommate asks if she can use his block of cheddar to make a sandwich, Mo gives it to her despite wanting it for himself, thus overriding his strong craving. That is, he resists the cheese's siren call. The team then asked participants, quote, how much self-control did Mo exercise in order to not eat the cheese? Respondents could answer from 1 for none to 7 for a lot. Participants rated Mo high in self-control when he gave his roommate the cheese in the moment, the team found. But they rated him low in self-control when he begged and pleaded for the cheese the next day. In other words, lay people have not received social psychologists' memo that strategic planning constitutes self-control. And not just any self-control, but the best kind. The study shows that self-control researchers have not done enough to investigate laypeople's understanding of self-control, says Fries, who was not involved with the study. We have our own terminology and we are doing research based on that terminology, but it's not really aligned with what laypeople may think. The mismatch makes it hard for scientists to communicate the power of preemptive strategies to the public. But expanding the meaning of self-control might also be making it hard for scientists to communicate with each other. There is no scientific consensus on what self-control is and what it is not, Fujita says, depending on who you talk to and depending on who their theoretical vantage point, they might be using the same word to mean very different things. Psychologists' expansion of the term self-control runs counter to thousands of years of language use, Srapada says. Researchers and the public they hope to reach would be better off finding another term to describe the superior, preemptive, tie-yourself-to-the-mast strategies, and they can stick to the original idea of self-control as equivalent to resisting the temptation in the moment, or willpower. With that in mind, Srapada suggests an alternate phrasing when communicating to people about how to achieve their New Year's resolutions. And that is, quote, do you want to keep your New Year's resolutions? Then don't rely on self-control. That is a sucker's game. And that's the end of this article. I love this because it really does pull that thread of willpower versus self-control. Self-control, for me, has always implied that if the drink is in front of me and I shouldn't have it, I can say no. It doesn't mean I'm telling my friends to not let me have something. One of them is buying an insurance policy or locking something away from yourself, while one is simply allowing yourself to have the freedom to make the choice, but abstaining from it. Something, something, something. Vices and superfluities. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this particular article. If somewhere in time you have felt that you have exhibited one or both of these, I certainly have done things like not bought junk food so that I don't eat it. And I've also bought junk food and said, no, I'm not going to eat that even though I want it. But, you know, as soon as I finish this podcast, I'm going to go have an ice cream sandwich. That's a fact. So, that's it for this week. I want to thank everyone out there for joining us on this edifying episode. Want to give another shout out to our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of this show. Again, without you, we can't do the show, and you guys make it all possible. If you're curious on how you can help support the WCY podcast, head on over to our website, WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out your various options. As another reminder, we did relaunch the Lyceum. New issues will be coming very soon, and under the moniker of the Masonic Education Alliance, with our awesome board members who are all taking an active part in both curating content, writing original content, all with the end goal of bringing Masonic education to those who prefer to read it and who'd like to open up a PDF on their favorite e-reader or iPad or whatever, and read your Masonic education that way. So until next week, stay on the level for Whence Came You. I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.